Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, and this is On the Case, the podcast. Thanks for joining us for our premiere episode. In it, and all of our future shows, we will shine a light on the amazing work of law enforcement as they relentlessly search for a killer. We will also share the heartbreaking accounts of families and friends who have suffered unthinkable loss. And most importantly, we will give a voice to the victim and make sure it can never be silenced. Welcome to episode one of On the Case, the podcast. Stolen Dreams. Tonight, we're on the case in Panama City Beach, Florida, a popular vacation destination known for its white sandy beaches. But the peaceful seaside community was plunged into terror after 31-year-old Kelly Bailey was found savagely murdered in her own home. The crime left her family heartbroken and forced investigators to piece together a disturbing trail of clues in pursuit of her killer. November 2nd, 2001. It was just before 9 p.m. when the Panama City Beach Police Department got a frantic call about the unexplained death of 31-year-old Kelly Bailey. Detective Sergeant Rodney Tilley.
It was from the victim's stepfather, John Greathouse, and he had gone to his daughter's house and found that she was dead.
A devastated John Greathouse told the dispatcher that he had stopped by to check on Kelly after a coworker suggested that she may have overslept for her shift as a medical technologist at a local hospital.
I've called her two times. And she didn't answer. I said, I'll call you back in a few minutes. I'll run around and wake her up.
Kelly's parents only lived a half mile away from her home, so John rushed over to her house to check on her. He saw Kelly's car out front, so he used his key to quietly let himself in. What he walked into was a nightmare no parent should ever have to see.
I walked through the kitchen, and I saw her foot sticking out of the bedroom door, and I went straight to it. I just grabbed her leg down there at the back, and it was ice cold.
John knew immediately that Kelly was dead.
Once I grabbed her leg and felt how cold she was, I knew what the situation was.
In fact, John was so shocked by what he had seen, his daughter, almost naked, lying lifeless on the floor, that he didn't even notice the blood or the other signs of a violent attack.
I covered her up, got the telephone, went out in the middle of the road and called the police.
When Detective Tilley arrived, he found Kelly Bailey lying face down in the doorway of her bedroom wearing only a t-shirt. At first glance, he thought her death could have been accidental.
The footboard of her bed was a round solid wood, and her head was right next to it. And I just wanted to be sure she didn't have a seizure or she didn't fall, hit her head on this post.
But one quick look around the room, and the detective realized that the young woman had not suffered a tragic fall. Instantly, a clear picture of the gruesome attack came into focus.
I saw blood slung up on the ceiling and all the way across the room. And it was that point that I said, hey, this is a homicide, and we need to move up to the next gear.
Investigators then turned over Kelly's body.
Some of her teeth were missing. Her nose turned out to be broken, and it was resting in a pool of blood.
Prosecutor Steve Meadows.
She had abrasions, and she had significant bruising from blunt force injury. The brutality of it was evident.
Detectives discovered a man's T-shirt soaked in blood on top of Kelly's bed. They also found streaks of blood in the bathroom sink, suggesting the killer had tried to clean up before fleeing the scene. Bloodstains on a rug in the living room indicated where the violence may have begun, but it was clear that Kelly's life had ended in the doorway of her bedroom. Despite the evidence found at the crime scene, detectives had no idea how and why the attack unfolded.
The only thing I would say I was definite of was that she had been beaten severely.
There were no signs of forced entry, and it didn't appear that robbery had been the motive for the crime.
The furniture hadn't been messed up, things weren't out of whack, and the blood was limited to the location she was at.
With no sign of a struggle inside the home, investigators theorized that Kelly was most likely ambushed, giving her no chance to fight back. And detectives couldn't help but wonder if the assailant was someone who she had willingly let into her home.
You know, you go with statistics, and statistics tells you that somebody that the victim knows. And that's where I started.
Investigators weren't able to determine whether the victim had been sexually assaulted, but their instincts told them she had been.
You can't tell at the scene, but she had a T-shirt on, and that was it.
Police then broke the shocking news about how his daughter died to John Greathouse.
They told me someone had murdered her. Did not tell me what happened. Had no earthly idea.
Kelly's grief-stricken stepfather was already suffering through the worst night of his life when police began asking him some pointed questions. He wondered if they were actually looking at him as a possible suspect in her death.
One of the detectives took me to his car and questioned me where I had been, what I had done, and went through all of the rituals.
Investigators quickly determined that John had nothing to do with Kelly's murder. But as painful as it was to face the suspicion of police, John was agonizing over something else. How would he find the words to tell his wife, Charlotte, that the beautiful young woman they had raised together had been murdered?
I had to call Charlotte then and tell her.
John Greathouse was still reeling from the shock of finding his daughter dead in her own home when he made that terrible call.
It was horrible. No way to describe it, to be honest with you. My mind went away from me. Hardest phone call I ever made in my life.
It was past midnight when John tracked down Charlotte, who was out of town visiting family.
It was just the shock of a lifetime. I said, was she in an automobile accident? And he said, no. And I said, well, what could have happened? And he said, well, they think someone took her life. And I said, who on earth would take Kelly's life?
And, of course, she went hysterical, and we were all crying so bad. Someone took from us the most wonderful thing in the world.
On the Case, the podcast, will continue in a moment. As Charlotte made the long trek home to plan her daughter's funeral, she was trying to come to terms with her deep sense of loss.
And just disbelief, how could this happen? This just can't be real. I just can't accept that this is real. It's just a shocking reality of how something so evil could happen to such an innocent, sweet girl.
Kelly was Charlotte's only child, and they had shared a very special bond.
We had always been really close, and we talked every day. The day just wasn't complete until we talked a little bit. We had a very loving relationship. I was so blessed by that. And right after she died, my first thought was, how will I ever survive without talking to Kelly every day?
When John and Charlotte got married, Kelly was just a toddler, and the three-year-old already had him wrapped around her finger.
She was my stepdaughter, but she was my daughter, really. I loved her, and we were always real close.
John and Charlotte watched Kelly blossom into an intelligent and ambitious young woman who earned degrees in both biology and medical technology.
She wanted to be the best in everything. She wanted to make the best grades. She wanted to be number one. And that's the way she did everything.
While Kelly was hardworking and driven, she also had a sensitive and compassionate side.
Kelly was a very giving person. She had a very soft heart. She had such a trusting, sweet personality.
Kelly had just recently moved back to Florida from Tennessee. She had accepted a new job so she could be closer to her family. John and Charlotte were overjoyed to have her home again.
We just miss being together. We worried about her safety there. We worried about her getting off at midnight and going into a dark parking lot, never dreaming that where she was coming to would be the place that was unsafe for her.
Kelly had just bought herself a new home, just a short distance away from her parents, fulfilling a lifelong dream.
I think it was a major accomplishment for her to have her own home. We were very proud of her.
Her parents knew the neighborhood well, and they felt confident that she would be safe living alone there.
It was a neighborhood where nobody locked their doors, never thought about it.
With Kelly only a couple minutes away, Charlotte and John took advantage of having her nearby.
We went by her house to help her do something around the house almost every day. So we talked to her every day and saw her almost every day.
But tragically, the close-knit family that had just been reunited was shattered in a flash of terrifying violence. Just hours after she was found murdered, Kelly's body was taken to the Bay County Medical Examiner's Office for an autopsy. The details of her murder shocked even the most hardened members of law enforcement. Detective Sergeant Rodney Tilley.
Her neck had been broken, and this caused her to be paralyzed from the shoulders down. So she ended up suffocating because her lungs weren't able to breathe.
Investigators knew that the killer would have had to use an extreme amount of force to inflict those types of injuries that Kelly had suffered.
It was a lot. I mean, you're breaking bones. That's pretty aggressive.
The autopsy also revealed that Kelly had been sexually assaulted. prosecutor Steve Meadows.
This is horrific a death as one could ever imagine. She was paralyzed from the shoulders down because he had snapped her neck. So she was suffocating and unable to move her arms or legs. Not only had he beaten her severely, but he had also raped her.
Biological evidence was collected to compare to a suspect. But first, police would have to find one. Officers canvassed Kelly's quiet neighborhood and were surprised when they couldn't find a single witness who had seen or heard anything around the time of the murder. Investigators were frustrated. They had believed that since the houses in the area were so close to one another, they were bound to turn up a lead.
They're fairly close, probably about 10 to 15 feet between each house.
Detectives were intrigued when they learned that one of Kelly's closest neighbors was an ex-boyfriend named Steve. Police quickly became troubled by his odd behavior.
He was almost overly cooperative. He was trying to be so helpful and also wanting to know about things. You know, somebody that's overly concerned does kind of stand out.
Kelly's ex continued to raise red flags when he openly admitted that he still had a key to her house. Given the fact that there was no forced entry into the home, Steve quickly moved to the top of their suspect list.
He was right there next door to her former boyfriend, and the fact that he was trying to be so helpful, those things do make him stand out.
And as police dug deeper, their suspicions only grew. Kelly's ex had a criminal history.
It does make your hair stand up a little bit on the back of your neck and give you another reason to look at them.
Detectives knew that Kelly had recently begun dating again, and they wondered whether the rage-fueled attack could have been triggered by jealousy. Investigators asked Steve to submit to a voice stress analysis.
And the way that thing works is it measures the stress levels in their voices. There was a set of 11 questions. There's only two of what we call hot questions.
The most important question police wanted answered was, were you involved in the murder of Kelly Bailey? The results of the tests were surprising.
He didn't show any stress, which leads you to believe that he wasn't involved.
But investigators needed to be certain. They obtained a sample of Steve's DNA for comparison with the biological evidence they had recovered. It was not a match. When police told Kelly's parents that her ex had been officially cleared, they were relieved.
I knew him too well. He'd been over and I'd been to his house. I trusted him. He was a very nice guy.
I never believed that he would have been involved.
But there were other men in Kelly's life that her parents had been worried about. The strangers the 31-year-old had been meeting through internet dating sites.
I was very concerned about online dating. People are much more comfortable with it now than they were then.
Still, Kelly had never expressed fear or concern about anyone she had met online.
She had never had a problem. She was cautious not to invite anyone to her home or not to go to anyone else's home. So she did all the things she thought would keep you safe.
police tried to track down anyone Kelly had actually gone out with through a dating site, when a call came in that would change the course of the investigation. Evidence that appeared to be connected to the crime.
We received a call that a jacket had been found in the wooded lot close to Kelly's house. A windbreaker that contained Kelly Bailey's credit card in the pocket.
The jacket, which belonged to Kelly, was spotted with blood. Investigators fanned out across the lot to search the area. After a thorough investigation, police made a chilling discovery.
We found a fish bat.
Detectives quickly learned what a fish bat was used for.
It's like a small wooden bat. I had never heard of a fish bat up until that time. In the fishing industry, they use it to hit the fish over the head.
Kelly Bailey's blood was discovered when the foot-long piece of wood was tested. Since the fish bat and the jacket were found just steps from Kelly's home, police theorized that both had been discarded by her killer as he fled the crime scene. Detectives carefully examined the bat and noticed that it appeared to be new. They wondered if the killer had bought it at a nearby store.
I knew that if we could find where it had been purchased, that would give us a pool of suspects to look at.
It was a long shot, but it was also the first lead investigators had that might put them on the trail of Kelly's killer.
It was a rabbit hole we had to go down. We had to go that direction. We didn't want to leave anything to chance.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. Investigator Jeff Hare drew the difficult assignment of trying to track down the store where the fish bat had been purchased, but he knew that the odds were against him.
I didn't think they were good, to be honest with you.
Investigator Hare visited every fishing and sporting goods store in the area, but despite a painstaking effort, Hare was unable to locate a shop that sold that particular bat.
I was almost ready to throw in a towel, per se, on this. I'd gone to every single store there was.
Hare had been close to 24 stores without success.
It was almost a dead end at that point.
But Hare refused to give up. Even in his free time, he continued his relentless search.
I'd gone to Walmart shopping with the family, and I decided to go over to the sporting section again one more time to take a look.
Investigator Hare had already searched the Walmart shelves twice while on duty. But this time, he noticed a dusty handle of a fish bat barely sticking out along the floor. When he pulled it out, he was stunned. It appeared to be the same make and model as the one investigators found in the field.
It looked identical. I couldn't believe it.
Hare immediately took the fish bat to the manager. Using the Walmart computer system, they were able to determine exactly how many of the fish bats had been sold and when.
We learned that there were two sold in the past year. One was sometime back in March, and the other sold on October 27th.
The October 27th sale was just days before Kelly Bailey's murder. Hare asked the store manager for all the information about the sale. Within seconds, he was able to pull up the transaction on his computer.
The receipt showed a time, the register, the checkout counter itself, and which cameras possibly would have video on that incident.
The detective was intrigued. He immediately asked to see the surveillance video.
That was the next step. Still not certain if this is going to be the lead that I'm hoping for, but at least it's something.
What Hare discovered was better than he could have imagined. The videotape showed two men at the register with a cart full of groceries and the fish bat. There was no mistaking that the image was exactly what he was looking for.
It was crystal clear.
And when Hare was told the fish bat had been paid for with a personal check, he was certain he had a hot lead to work off of.
Now it's looking really good as far as making contact with who purchased this.
The investigator proceeded to trace the check.
They had a routing number for me, and we could find out which bank and then track the check down itself.
When Hare contacted the bank, he was disappointed. It turned out that the check used to make the purchase had been reported stolen weeks earlier. Then Hare discovered there might be another way to identify the man who bought the bat.
Walmart's policy was that you had to have a driver's license, so there was a driver's license number along with the receipt.
Unfortunately, the driver's license Walmart gave the detective would also be of little use.
I had made contact with the individual with the driver's license, and they had advised me that the wallet had been stolen with the driver's license in the wallet.
Hare confirmed the man's story. In fact, a police report had been filed in Alabama about the stolen wallet just days before Kelly's murder.
So we had a stolen driver's license along with a stolen check making a purchase of a fish bat.
But just when it seemed Hare had hit another dead end, the officer in Alabama dropped a bombshell.
I was advised by the authorities there was a suspect in a theft of that driver's license. Paul Everett.
Investigators looked into the name Paul Everett and discovered that the 22-year-old had a criminal history that included theft and forgery. In fact, it turned out that the stolen check had belonged to Everett's late grandfather. And when Hare compared Everett's booking photos to the images of the man at the Walmart cash register, he became convinced he was on the right track.
He was the individual in the video purchasing the fish bat.
Suddenly, the pieces of a very complicated puzzle were falling into place. And Detective Hare was convinced the huge break wasn't due to luck alone.
I think it's a little more than luck. I'd like to think that Kelly had something to do with it. I had a connection to Kelly Bailey somehow, and I believe she was helping us along the way. I really do.
Investigators would need all the help and inspiration they could get. After all, they still had a lot of work to do if they hoped to arrest Paul Everett for the murder of Kelly Bailey. For one thing, they had to find him. One of Detective Hare's first steps was to contact the family of his 22-year-old suspect in Alabama, hoping for a lead on his whereabouts. Hare was surprised by their cooperation. In fact, Everett's family confirmed for the detective a stunning piece of information.
I learned that he had been in Panama City during the time of the homicide and possibly was still in Panama City.
Everett's family even gave the investigator the name of the motel where he'd been staying. It was just a short distance from Kelly's house.
It was 1/10 of a mile. Very close proximity.
Not only had Everett's family helped place him in Panama City Beach during the time frame of the murder, The case against him continued to mount when police went looking for Everett at the motel. The manager said that Paul Everett had been taken into custody by a bail bondsman on the night of November 2nd, the very night of Kelly's murder. And the bail bondsman described the unusual way Everett was dressed when they arrested him.
They stated that he had no shirt, no shoes, and he was transported with nothing but the clothes that he had on at the time.
Police knew that Kelly's killer had left his blood-soaked T-shirt on her bed. Investigators came to the realization that the bail bondsman probably picked up Everett just a short time after Kelly Bailey had been murdered.
Based on the times that we had, I would say he had just been back within a few hours.
Each new detail police discovered added to their case against Paul Everett. The location where Kelly's jacket and the fish bat were found was along the path where Everett would have had traveled to return to his motel room.
Well, when we went back and diagrammed it, you had basically a trail back to the motel.
And a search of Paul Everett's motel room revealed a man who was deeply disturbed and filled with rage.
There was a trunk with some odd things inside of that, notes and just scribbled, very evil content. I would say we're dealing with the devil.
After reading the letters found in Everett's room, investigators believe that nothing would have stopped him from trying to inflict pain on an unsuspecting female that night.
Paul Everett was going to kill somebody while he was in Panama City Beach, and it just happened to be Kelly Bailey. He was going to hurt someone, and she was the one.
Investigators knew the next step was to question Everett face-to-face in the Alabama jail where he was being held. Detective Tilley decided to begin the interview without revealing that Kelly had died during the attack.
We were going to hit it as if it was just a burglary that had gone bad and she had been roughed up.
When questioned, Everett claimed he had no knowledge about a crime committed at Kelly Bailey's house, and he was adamant he had never even met her.
He had no idea. He didn't know anything.
When Detective Tilley turned up the pressure, Everett shut down, asking the investigator for a lawyer. But before the detectives left the room, they let Everett know exactly how much trouble he was in.
My partner told him that she was dead and that he was facing the death penalty. At that time, Everett looked at me and said, "She's dead." I gave him my business card and I said, "If you want to talk any more about this, just give us a call."
It wasn't long before Everett asked for another chance to tell the truth. This time, Everett admitted he had been at Kelly's home on the night of the murder, but claimed it was another man who killed her.
He brought up that he was with a fellow named Bubba, and that Kelly Bailey was Bubba's girlfriend.
Everett said Bubba was jealous that he and Kelly had been romantically involved that night.
He said they had consensual sex and that Bubba caught him sitting there half naked. Bubba pulled out a pistol and pointed it at Paul and said, "You need to leave." And Paul said the last thing he saw was Bubba grabbing her by the hair and pulling her down in the doorway.
Investigators didn't believe anything Everett said. The story seemed to be a weak attempt to explain away the evidence police had found. Still, what Paul Everett had admitted to was very valuable to building a case against him.
He put himself at the scene, having sex with her. I think he eventually thought we were going to track him down through DNA.
And Everett was right. His DNA was a match to the biological evidence collected at the crime scene. Paul Everett was arrested for the first-degree murder of Kelly Bailey. When investigators presented him with a warrant, Everett said he was finally ready to come clean. Now he had a dramatically different story of what happened on the night of the crime.
He said that he was strung out looking for money, and that the only reason he picked Kelly's house was it was the nicest looking one on the block. He described walking to the front of the house, and he knocked on the front door. There was no answer, so he tried the door, and it was open. He says, I opened the door, and I could see the purse sitting on the table.
Everett said while he was rifling through Kelly's purse, he heard someone coming out of the shower.
He states that she saw him going through the purse, and she actually charged him. He says, I had the fish billy in my left hand. I turned around, and out of instinct, he said, I just punched her twice in the face with my right hand.
Everett denied using the fish bat, but claimed his punch knocked Kelly off her feet.
He says she fell down to the floor, and she jumped up and ran to the bedroom. And at that time, he said, I have a blank from then on.
Investigators were still convinced that Everett's story was an attempt to minimize the horror of his crime. Bay County State Attorney Steve Meadows told the jury how he conveniently left out the gruesome details of his attack on Kelly.
Why he selected this particular house, we'll never know, but he selected her home for whatever reason. And once he went in, he was taking money from her purse. He was surprised by her. And instead of running out the front door, he ran towards her. He made that conscious decision at that time that he was not there just for the money, but he was there for her as well.
Everett then sexually assaulted and savagely murdered Kelly Bailey. After he was arrested and had given a statement to police, Detective Tilley shared the news with Kelly's family.
I'm sure they were very glad to hear the news, but it's not something they're going to jump up and cheer about because they're still dealing with the loss of their daughter.
The Greathouses were surprised to hear the name of Paul Everett. They were not familiar with him at all.
He was a stranger to us. He had come from Alabama and made his way to Panama City Beach.
When Everett's trial began in late 2002, prosecutors were seeking the death penalty.
If not this case, what case? This is the poster of what a death penalty case would look like. The decision was made based upon were the aggravating factors present in this case, and they were in abundance. This case cried out for the death penalty.
Prosecutor Steve Meadows began by introducing the jury to Kelly and describing her life at the time of her murder.
I wanted the jurors to come to know Kelly Bailey, and so I put a lot of effort into letting the jurors know who she was and how he'd really taken a beautiful life and destroyed a beautiful family.
Meadows told the jurors how Kelly had left her comfortable life in Tennessee to move to Panama City Beach to be closer to her family.
All the things that she loved were here. And she had begun a new career, a new life. Panama City Beach is idyllic. You see open sea and beautiful sand dunes and a small town that's friendly, and it felt safe. And It was an illusion because it wasn't safe. Paul Glenn Everett disproved that.
Meadows even talked about Kelly's new home and how proud she was to be able to save enough money to purchase it on her own.
She loved this home, and you could tell that whenever you walked in there, because everything about the home was thought out. It was meticulously decorated, meticulously maintained.
Then he laid out what he believed happened on the night of November 2nd, and how everything Kelly had worked for was destroyed in a flash of violence. Everett remained stoic as the prosecutor presented the overwhelming evidence against him.
We had more evidence than you would typically see in this type of case. We had his admissions, which were significant. We also had his DNA. And we had video of him buying the fish belly. All of this collectively was overwhelming.
For John and Charlotte Greathouse, the trial convinced them of what they already knew. Not only was Everett a cold-blooded killer, he was also a coward.
He couldn't look at us. He couldn't talk. He didn't say anything.
Everett's attorneys tried to argue that their client was on drugs at the time of the crime and could not be responsible for his actions.
His main defense was that he had said he had taken LSD and did not seem to recall events.
Charlotte Greathouse was deeply offended by the defense's strategy.
I guess the hardest part is hearing them plead for a life for a person that's not worthy of one. Really, it's just like almost insulting after what he has done. Try to reason for why he did what he did when there is none.
The jury unanimously agreed. Paul Everett was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to death.
Burn in hell, Paul Everett.
Prosecutor Steve Meadows says he believes it was just punishment.
He has an evil heart. There is evil in the world, and it's exemplified through individuals like Paul Glenn Everett, who are indifferent to the suffering that they impose on others, and they think only of themselves.
Still, the courtroom victory brought him no pleasure.
You don't walk away with any feeling of joy, because Kelly Bailey's still dead. Her mom and dad are still dealing with the tragedy that occurred. So, you know, there's relief. There's acknowledgement that you're grateful that the jury did the right thing. But you don't walk away with elation.
For Kelly's family, the verdict was bittersweet.
12 jurors voted for justice, but it will take the execution of the defendant for us to know that this journey is done. An execution will not give me any relief, but it's the justice that we were promised, and it's the justice we want.
There's nothing that you could be happy about, because we're having to live without her. Her life has been taken from us. It's been a struggle. It has certainly been a struggle. What is justice for us? I don't know.
Charlotte and John are grateful to the investigators who solved Kelly's case. They realize when it comes to victims' families, they are among the fortunate ones.
Many families never know what happened to their loved one, so we consider it a miracle that they solved the crime like they did, as quickly as they did.
They also feel gratitude for the bond they formed with the investigative team.
We were blessed to have such good, kind individuals that embraced us during this most painful journey. We were so blessed.
In fact, the Greathouses and the investigators on Kelly's case have remained close to this day. Detective Sergeant Rodney Tilley.
They're good friends of mine. And I make sure every November 2nd, they get a phone call from me. And then on Christmas, if I'm in town visiting my folks, I stop by and visit with the Great Houses. And, you know, we just are close like that.
Today, the Great House family remains focused on turning their grief into something positive. And they put their energy into an annual event called Missing Place at the Table. The special night helps families who've lost loved ones to violent crime celebrate their lives and honor their memory. Charlotte Greathouse feels a special connection when she sets a place at the table for Kelly. It's an opportunity for her to reflect on happier times and remind herself of all the wonderful memories she has of the time she spent with her daughter.
I celebrate a life of joy and goodness. Kelly had such a kind heart, and I look at her accomplishments. She graduated from college, was in 3 honor societies. She did not let anything keep her from her goals. I just think of so much love and pride in the woman that she had become.
The Great Houses say that it has been the strength of other survivors who have helped them get through their darkest hours. But still, the emptiness never goes away. Today, their pain remains very deep.
He took a lot of the happiness away from us. He took our daughter's life, just yanked it away from us, and it hurt us so bad, our hearts, and we'll never get over it as long as we live.
Missing Place at the Table is an annual tradition that has honored more than 125 victims. On the organization's 10th anniversary, the Great House family invited the investigators who worked on Kelly's case to attend the dinner. Please join us next time when we're back on the case.